It's lovely to have a cat purring on your lap or a dog greet you at the door. How do companion animals affect our health? This is the People's Pharmacy with Terry and Joe Graydon.
Research has shown that interacting with friendly animals can reduce stress and help people lower their blood pressure and heart rate. Veterans who return from combat with PTSD may benefit from a trusted canine companion.
What are the health implications of our relationships with dogs, cats, and other creatures?
The bond between humans and animals has enormous power. Do people risk their lives to save the animals they love?
Coming up on the People's Pharmacy, a doctor discusses our symphony with animals on health, empathy, and our shared destiny.
In the People's Pharmacy Health Headlines, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, or NSAIDs, are increasingly linked to cardiovascular disease. Over a decade ago, researchers discovered that rofecoxib, also known as Vioxx, increased the risk for heart attacks and strokes. Since then, clinicians have been trying to determine whether other NSAIDs like ibuprofen, diclofenac, meloxicam, or naproxen could also be hard on the vascular system. The most recent epidemiological study was conducted in Canada. More than 7,000 patients with osteoarthritis and three times that many non-arthritic control subjects were tracked for about a decade. People with arthritis are at greater risk for cardiovascular disease than healthy individuals. In this study, with approximately 300,000 person-years of follow-up, more than 9,000 participants developed cardiovascular complications. Those with arthritis were about 31% more likely to have this outcome than people without arthritis. Patients with osteoarthritis were much more likely to be taking an NSAID pain reliever. Upon analysis, the investigators found that NSAID use accounted for more than 40% of the increased risk of heart problems among Canadians with arthritis. This result is in line with other research suggesting that non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs increase cardiovascular risk by 30 to 40%.
Sometimes people who feel they need their best mental performance in college or at work will take a stimulant to boost their cognitive function. Researchers at the University of California, Irvine say this is a mistake. The scientists recruited 43 young adults and gave them a battery of tests of memory and attention. Then the volunteers returned twice more to the lab for repeat testing throughout the day and an overnight stay in the sleep lab. At each visit, they took either a placebo pill or dextroamphetamine, a drug similar to Adderall. The results were disappointing. People who had taken the medication performed about 4% better on attention tasks, but no better at all on memory tests. Although their attention performance deteriorated back to baseline during the day, those who had taken the stimulant did not sleep well at night. The cognitive test 24 hours after ingesting the drug showed significant slips in working memory. Consequently, the researchers conclude people who are taking these drugs to perform better in school or at work may feel as though they are doing better, but our data don't support this feeling.
People with diabetes need to keep tabs on their blood sugar. That allows them to use treatment that will keep it within a normal range. New research from the Mayo Clinic shows that 1 in 5 patients with this metabolic condition may be overtreated with diabetes drugs. The consequence is that their blood sugar goes too low. In fact, the investigators attribute more than 4,700 hospitalizations and over 4,800 emergency department visits in 2 years to overtreatment-induced hypoglycemia. They suggest that many more people suffer hypoglycemia but don't end up in the hospital. Low blood sugar levels are associated with falls and fractures, cognitive impairment, cardiovascular disease, and premature death.
Danish researchers report that people with type 2 diabetes might do well to skip the Danish at breakfast. That's because a diet lower in carbohydrates with more fat and protein can help people keep their blood sugar under control. The investigators conducted a 3-month-long study in which 28 people with type 2 diabetes followed a low-carb, higher-fat diet or a higher-carb diet that adhered to dietary recommendations for diabetes. Calories were controlled to prevent weight loss. People who followed the low-carb diet did better on regulating blood sugar. In addition, they had less fat in their livers at the end of the study. And that's the health news from the People's Pharmacy this week. Welcome to the People's Pharmacy. I'm Joe Graydon.
And I'm Terry Graydon. Today we're talking about how our relationships with animals can shape our health as well as theirs.
Dr. Aisha Akhtar is board certified in both neurology and preventive medicine. She also holds a master's degree in public health. Dr. Akhtar is deputy director of the Army's Traumatic Brain Injury Program. She's a lieutenant commander in the United States Public Health Service and a fellow of the Oxford Center for Animal Ethics. Her books include Animals and Public Health, and her most recent, Our Symphony with Animals, on Health, Empathy, and Our Shared Destinies.
Welcome to the People's Pharmacy, Dr. Aisha Akhtar.
Thank you so much for having me here, Terry and Joe.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today on the People's Pharmacy. Your expertise is in neurology and preventive medicine and public health. And I guess we live in an era these days of tremendous, I hate to say it, but divisiveness. I mean, our country seems, you know, in not just two camps, but maybe multiple camps. And there's just this one area, it seems like we can all come together where we all can relate to one another. And that's with our companion animals. I mean, you can be out on a playground, you can be walking in the country on a in the forest. And if somebody else comes along with a dog, I mean, you're sort of almost immediately friends. Why do you think that is?
I think that's because they are not humans. And I think that's why we are innately attracted to other animals. As a matter of fact, there's a theory called biophilia that was proposed by biologist Edward Wilson back in the 1970s that suggested that humans, as a species, we have an innate desire to connect with other species. And that included plants and insects and animals, but I really do believe that it's with animals where our biophilia is especially evident. And so I think that innate desire to connect with animals is part of our quest to find companionship, not to feel lonely in this world, right? And so there's something about other species that just draws us precisely because they are different from us. Even though they share many of the same emotions and internal lives that we do, ultimately, I really do believe it's their differences from us that cause us to be so attracted to them. I think in some ways they help relieve some of that human-generated pressure in our lives because they're not competing with us in the way that other humans do. They help remind us to step away from the stresses of our lives and just to be for the moment. And I think everyone who's had a companion animal can say how their dogs or their cats or other critters just help them to stop and be in that moment. And I think that's one part of why animals are so healing for us in so many ways and why we seek them out.
Well, I know there's research showing that people who are accompanied by their animal, their dog or their cat, have lower blood pressure even when they're doing something stressful than if they were accompanied by a spouse or a partner or a family member.
You're absolutely right. You know, you think about this, and when you think about our relationships with other people, you know, I love my mom, I love my husband, but they can also cause me a lot of stress. They can annoy me at times. But my cat Silos, for example, he may do a few little things that cause him problems, but in general, he doesn't stress me out the way my mom does, you know? And I think that's what a lot of us are experiencing when we're with animals. And you're right, there are studies that really do show that when we are with animals in a good relationship, a good empathetic relationship with animals, our blood pressure gets lowered, our heart rate gets lowered. Also, levels of stressful hormones like cortisol and epinephrine get lowered as well. So the studies are actually suggesting that being with animals can increase our longevity and boost our cardiovascular health.
I want to ask you about a super stressful time for a lot of human beings and what it revealed about our relationship with our companion animals. Hurricane Katrina swept into New Orleans, inundated the city. People had to evacuate unexpectedly. And some places it was expected that they would have to evacuate, but a lot of people weren't actually expecting that they would need to leave the city in such a hurry. And when they left, a lot of them couldn't take their companion animals with them. Can you tell us a little bit about that, please?
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought up Hurricane Katrina because in many ways it was a wake-up call for our first responders and our governmental agencies to really take our relationships with animals seriously, to understand that we, here in this country, we see our animals as part of our family. They are not separate from us. And during the hurricane, one of the major reasons why people refused to evacuate was because they were not allowed to take their animals on board buses and in shelters. And that caused widespread devastating problems, long-term problems. Studies showed that those who lost animals during Hurricane Katrina were much more likely to experience immediate distress, post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, and anxiety that went above and beyond even the stress that they felt if they lost their homes, for example. So their relationships with animals were incredibly important to them, and that losing that relationship was also very devastating.
Dr. Akhtar, I wonder if you could tell us how you came up with the title, Our Symphony with Animals, and perhaps a little bit about your own history.
Sure. So when I was 5 years old, that was when I was being sexually abused. It started when I was 5 years old by an uncle. And that abuse continued for 5 years. When I turned 9 years old, though, my grandparents who lived next door adopted a dog named Sylvester, who became, you know, the love of my life. He became my absolute best friend. And unfortunately, we shared something more than just our love. I came across Sylvester being physically abused by yet another uncle. And it took me a while, but ultimately it was my empathy and my love for Sylvester that gave me the courage to stand up and speak out. And I was able to end his abuse, and that led me to have the courage to speak out and end my abuse. So today, you know, I'm a neurologist, and I look back at that and I realize it was my empathy for an animal that profoundly changed my life for the better. So the reason behind the book was, you know, I wanted to ask, where does that empathy for animals come from and how does it affect all of us, not just as individuals, but collectively as a society? What do we gain when we recognize our empathy for animals and what do we lose when we don't? So that was the story behind why I did this. I decided to write this book. I spent 5 years traveling around the country interviewing a whole host of people whose lives were profoundly changed, impacted in some way by their relationships with animals. And as far as the titles, Our Symphony with Animals, that came about because I was sitting at an animal sanctuary. This is a sanctuary for farmed animals, many of whom were abused, pigs and cows and so forth. And I was sitting there one evening. It was a warm summer evening. And as I was sitting in the grass, there was a pig named Ivy who was gently snoring in her sleep. I heard the dogs, the rescue dogs, barking in the background. I heard the birds chirping up in the trees above me. I heard the cows mooing and the horses neighing. And I heard the founders, the Tommy and Renee Kingsonen, who were the founders of the sanctuary, heard them chuckling over something off in the distance. And as I was hearing this, all these sounds together, it reminded me of Mozart's symphonies, his music I absolutely love. And it just, there was something so beautiful about the sounds of all these animals and humans together, all living in a kind of a peace and harmony. And I just found it to be absolutely beautiful as Mozart's music.
It's so interesting you mentioned farm animals. I grew up on a dairy farm in my early years, and my uncle, who was a bachelor, loved his cows. He had a name for every cow. And one time he actually sold a calf, and the mother cow, started crying. And she mm-hmm. cried day in and day out until he couldn't stand it any longer, and he bought back the calf. And,
oh, wow.
And she and the calf were happy again, and he was too. I mean, he had a special bond with all of his animals. And, you know, I saw that, and it was a profound experience, because that was his family.
That's an amazing story. I don't know if you've ever watched The Waltons, but there was an episode that sounds almost word for word like what you just described. There was an episode of The Waltons where the father, he needed money, and he sold a calf, a newborn calf, who the kids had really grown in love with. And after the calf was sold, the mother was crying for her baby. And it was such a similar situation. And ultimately, the show had a good ending, that they were able to buy the calf back. And so the whole family was happy with this resolution. You're right. I think, you know, our family members can go beyond dogs and cats. It doesn't have to be just dogs and cats. It could be cows. It could be pigs. It could be mice. I think that empathetic bond and that need to connect with another species transcends the boundaries, in a sense that it could be with any type of species out there. We hear about, you know, some remarkable relationships that people have had with all kinds of different animals from different countries that we would never necessarily associate with as companions here, but that does happen. And it suggests, you know, that there's so much that we can get from these good, kind relationships with each other, that the animals experience something positive, and so do we.
You're listening to Dr. Aisha Akhtar, author of Our Symphony with Animals, on health, empathy, and our shared destinies. She's deputy director of the Army's Traumatic Brain Injury Program. Dr. Akhtar is a fellow of the Oxford Center for Animal Ethics and a consultant editor for the Journal of Animal Ethics.
After the break, we'll hear more about the therapeutic effects of animals.
What's Dr. Akhtar's role in treating veterans with brain injuries?
We'll learn about one veteran and the dog who rescued him.
Companion animals are often at risk in situations of domestic violence. What can be done? You're listening to The People's Pharmacy with Joe and Terry Graydon.
Welcome back to The People's Pharmacy. I'm Joe Graydon.
And I'm Terry Graydon. If you'd like to purchase a CD of this show, you can call 800-732-2334. This is show number 1176. That number again, 800-732-2334. Or you can find it online at peoplespharmacy.com. You can also download the podcast from our website or wherever you get your podcasts.
The People's Pharmacy is brought to you in part by Verizana, an analytical laboratory providing home health tests for hormones, gut health, and the microbiome. Online at verisana.com.
Today, our topic is our relationship with animals. Do you have a companion animal? How well do you and your furry or feathered friend communicate? What are the implications for your health?
We're talking with Dr. Aisha Akhtar, board certified in both neurology and preventive medicine. She also holds a master's degree in public health. Dr. Akhtar is deputy director of the Army's Traumatic Brain Injury Program. She's a lieutenant commander in the U.S. Public Health Service, in which she deploys to assist with national public health emergencies. Dr. Akhtar is a fellow of the Oxford Center for Animal Ethics and a consultant editor for the Journal of Animal Ethics. Her books include Animals and Public Health and her most recent, Our Symphony with Animals, on Health, Empathy, and Our Shared Destinies.
Dr. Akhtar, it seems that animals can sometimes have therapeutic effects, but this is a relatively recent conclusion that scientists and doctors have come to. Would you tell us about Boris Levinson? The story in your book is amazing about how he was actually laughed at when he presented his findings. What had he found?
And sure.
Didn't they believe him?
Yeah. So Dr. Boris Levinson, he was a psychologist, and the situation you're describing occurred in 1961. And at this time, Dr. Levinson was standing up in front of the a packed audience at the American Psychological Association meeting in New York. And he was describing a case that was a baffling case. And it was about of a child who was brought to him by a desperate mother. And this child had, before coming to Dr. Levinson, had suddenly stopped talking and became withdrawn. And the mother couldn't figure out what was going on, and she had taken the child to multiple psychologists and psychiatrists, and no one could get through to the child. And as a last-ditch effort, she begged Dr. Levinson to see her child. So Dr. Levinson was describing this case, and you're right, when he was done, the audience started breaking out in laughter. They were, you know, having catcalls and things like that. And they were making fun of Dr. Levinson. And the reason why is because he suggested something that was different that they had never heard before, and it really shocked their sensibilities in a sense. What Dr. Levinson learned was what happened during one of the first visit with the child. So during the first visit, Dr. Levinson had in his office his dog Jingles. He loved animals. He adopted and rescued many animals. And when the boy first entered the office, Jingles did what Jingles always did. Jingles ran up to the boy and licked his face. And rather than shirking away from the dog, the boy did something that was really startling. He wrapped his arms around the dog, and he spoke the first words that he had spoken in months and said hello to Jingles. And Dr. Levinson, seeing this, wondered if, you know, Jingles was getting through to this boy in the way that no other person could. And he found that was the case. As he had further visits with the boy, with Jingles there, the boy continued to improve. And Dr. Levinson found that this was the case with many other children who were facing many similar situations. And it went beyond even just dogs. He saw this effect with cats as well. But in front of the American Psychological Association, he was suggesting that dogs could be co-therapists. And that's what led to the laughter and the ridicule. Unfortunately, Dr. Jingles has been proven right since then. Dr. Freud had noticed the calming effect animals can have on his patients. He initially brought his dog, one of his dogs, Jofi, who he loved, into his office to help him relax when he was seeing patients. But Dr. Freud very quickly realized that the dog's presence was helping his patients relax. And so now today we see this effect with animals across the board. And I'm sure many people have heard about how children are learning to read in the presence of dogs and cats because these animals kind of reduce their stress and anxiety and help the children be in a better position to learn. And we're seeing dogs and cats, you know, coming into hospitals and even airports to reduce people's stress and anxiety. So it's one example of how something that was so obvious to one doctor or psychiatrist, but how he faced so much ridicule. But since then, we now know that, oh, my God, Dr. Levinson is absolutely right. It makes perfect sense. People do relax when they're around animals.
Dr. Akhtar, you are deputy director of the Army's Traumatic Brain Injury Program. You're a lieutenant commander in the U.S. Public Health Service. You've probably had some interaction over the years with people who are dealing with post-traumatic stress disorder, what we used to call shell shock. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about Jason, who had spent three tours in Afghanistan and Iraq, came home clearly changed, profoundly changed, and not in a good way, and how Axel brought him back.
Sure. So this was Captain Jason Hogg. He was a Marine. And as you said, after his third tour in Iraq, he came back and his family immediately saw something was wrong with him. He was distant. He didn't show the enthusiasm he normally showed when being reunited with his family. And over the course of months and then into a year, he became more withdrawn from his family. He even became verbally and sometimes physically violent. He began throwing things against a wall, shouting at his kids, shouting at his wife. And his wife was desperate. She had tried so many different things to reach Jason. She had dragged him basically from one doctor to another. They tried hypnotherapy. They tried group therapy. They tried one-on-one psychotherapy. They tried what's called chronotherapy, which is an adjustment of light and darkness to try to improve his mood. They tried everything that was out there, and nothing, absolutely nothing, was working. And then his wife at some point finally said, "All right, Jason, you have to try one more thing. I'm giving you one last chance to try," because she was really at the end of she was really desperate, and she was being told by many that she needs to leave before her husband actually would hurt her or her children. And so she was giving Jason one last chance to try something. And Jason learned about Canines for Warriors, and it was a program in Florida in which they adopt dogs from high-kill shelters, and they train them to be partners with veterans with PTSD. So Jason, after a long waiting period, actually flew down and was partnered with Axel, a dog. And just that very first day he met Axel, he was seeing tremendous improvements. This was Jason. Jason, before he met Axel, he was barely leaving the house. He was shutting himself in his basement. And when he met Axel, that first day, they were going about all about town to places that he could never have seen himself doing before, just re-engaging back with life. And since then, and with Axel, Jason has continued to improve. He's never had to leave his family there together. And Jason has seen what a remarkable effect being a dog, you know, has made on his life, that now he works with Canines for Warriors and with other groups to help partner other veterans with dogs and other animals to help them as well.
That is a wonderful story. I want to ask about, you hinted that there was a concern that Jason's situation might actually turn into a domestic violence situation. And you have written in our Symphony with Animals about domestic violence and how animals, companion animals, can sometimes play into that, make it a little more complicated or a lot more complicated in some cases. Could you tell us about that, please?
Sure. Yeah. So having animals, if you're in a situation where you're being abused by a violent spouse, for example, having animals can be both helpful and dangerous. And that's the complicated factor. Studies have shown that, and these are studies that have mostly been on women who are victims of domestic violence, but it could be any partner. It could be a man. It could be in any kind of situation. But victims of domestic violence, studies have shown that they are much less likely to leave their abusive situation if they have an animal with them. And the reason why is because one is they've developed an incredibly strong bond with these animals. For many of these victims of violence, their animals are their source of comfort, their source of companionship, their source of healing. It's a one good relationship they may have in their lives. And the abusive partner in the situation knows about that bond, recognizes that bond between the person and the animal, and takes advantage of that bond. So the animals are often victims in a domestic violence situation. They are often hurt or killed by the abuser as a way to manipulate or punish the spouse or even children in violent situations like this. So because of that fear of having their animals being hurt, many victims of domestic violence will not leave their situation. And this has been seen again and again because they're worried about what will happen to their animals. That's compounded by the fact that only about 5% of shelters in the country, violent shelters in the country, allow animals. So so many domestic violence victims are finding themselves in a very, in even a worse situation than they already are. They want to leave their abusive situation, but they won't go unless they can take their beloved animals with them. But they're finding that there are very few places that will allow them to go with their animals. Because of this, there is a movement to try to create shelters for animals at these domestic violence shelters as well.
Dr. Akhtar, you've talked with a lot of people to create this book. You've traveled the country. You decided to meet a serial killer. Perhaps that was the most dramatic interview that you conducted. Would you tell us, please, how you met Keith Jesperson and what you learned from each other?
Sure. You know, so part of this book was not just to look at what do we gain when we embrace our empathy for animals, but also to look at the opposite. What happens when we don't embrace empathy for animals? And I think most people, most of the audience knows, we know that there's a connection between violent killers, serial killers, and animal abuse. We know that many of the serial killers in this country have started out abusing animals first. But we don't really know why and how that abuse started. Why did they get into hurting animals? And that's not something that's really been studied in depth. So for me to look at the opposite of, you know, our good relationships with animals, I started by looking at an extreme. I wanted to see how does abuse happen? How does abuse of animals happen? How do we squash empathy for animals and allow cruelty to happen? So I decided to, as I said, to start with extreme. So I started writing to Keith Jesperson, whom I had looked up, and I was looking for a serial killer who had acknowledged history of having abused animals in the past. And Keith Jesperson is serving life at the Oregon State Penitentiary for raping and murdering 8 women. And I just found out his contact information, and I reached out to him. I sent him a letter, and I said, you know, I'm a neurologist, and I'm studying empathy for animals. Could I talk with you about this? And he was intrigued because it was a new kind of question that was posed to him. Most people who have written him in the past have they tend to ask the same questions. So he was intrigued because I had something different to discuss. And we started out by having weekly phone calls, and we would correspond through letters. And ultimately, I also went and visited him at Oregon State Penitentiary. And one of the things with Keith is that what surprised me was that although he had been cruel to actually thousands of animals, incredibly cruel, he also had really surprising moments of empathy for animals. And it especially became evident when he was talking about his childhood. He tried to rescue a crow, for example, an injured crow, and nursed the crow back to health. Jesperson formed a strong bond with his childhood dog, an incredibly strong bond. And Jesperson also described a moment in adulthood when he was hunting a deer and he shot an arrow into a deer and the deer didn't die, and how he had to track the deer down for hours and the deer was crying. And that startled him to hear a deer actually crying, screaming and crying. And he said that it startled him so much to hear an animal crying that he didn't hunt deer again after that. And so there were these moments where what it suggests is that Keith Jesperson had innate empathy. It was there in him. He wasn't born just without this ability to empathize and feel kindness. It was the opposite. But what I learned is that it was his surrounding culture, his neighbors, his friends, his family, and especially his father, who ultimately crushed Keith Jesperson's empathy and taught him that cruelty was not only okay, but was actually something to be proud of. And even Keith Jesperson openly acknowledged in a very public way in a letter that he wrote how his cruelty towards animals directly led to him seeing violence in many ways, and then ultimately to his violence towards women as well.
You're listening to Dr. Aisha Akhtar. She's board certified in neurology and preventive medicine. She also holds a master's degree in public health. Dr. Akhtar is deputy director of the Army's Traumatic Brain Injury Program and a lieutenant commander in the U.S. Public Health Service. In that, she deploys to assist with national public health emergencies. Dr. Akhtar is a fellow of the Oxford Center for Animal Ethics and a consultant editor for the Journal of Animal Ethics. Her books include Animals and Public Health and her most recent, Our Symphony with Animals, on Health, Empathy, and Our Shared Destinies.
And Terry, this idea that our culture and the people around us can teach us empathy or cruelty?
Dr. Akhtar suggests that empathy may actually be inherent and our culture can encourage it or squash it.
Exactly. After the break, we're going to find out about Giolani's Pet Store and the Crazy Cat Lady of Brooklyn.
Crazy Cat Lady. Do animals serve as social lubricants? Are you more likely to chat with your neighbor walking a dog?
Are there some people who get particular benefit from hanging out with a companion animal?
When our beloved companions die, it can be hard. How should we acknowledge the grief? You're listening to The People's Pharmacy with Joe and Terry Graydon. Welcome back to The People's Pharmacy. I'm Terry Graydon.
And I'm Joe Graydon. To purchase a CD of today's show or any People's Pharmacy broadcast, you can call 800-732-2334. Today's show is 1176. That number again, 800-732-2334, online at peoplespharmacy.com. You can also download the free podcast from Apple, Stitcher, or from our web store. We invite you to consider writing a review.
The People's Pharmacy is brought to you in part by Kaya Biotics, probiotic products made in Germany from certified organic ingredients. KAYABiotics.com.
Can an animal change the trajectory of your life? Veterans with PTSD report that canine companionship can make a huge difference in helping control stress.
Our guest is Dr. Aisha Akhtar, author of Our Symphony with Animals, on health, empathy, and our shared destinies. She's deputy director of the Army's Traumatic Brain Injury Program and a lieutenant commander in the U.S. Public Health Service, in which she deploys to assist with national public health emergencies. Dr. Akhtar is a fellow of the Oxford Center for Animal Ethics and a consultant editor for the Journal of Animal Ethics.
Dr. Akhtar, you also talked to an interesting character, James Giuliani. He had a pet store, but his history is incredible. He was a mobster and a drug addict. Can you tell us a little bit about his story and the crazy cat lady of Brooklyn?
Yeah, James is a character to meet. James, he lived in Brooklyn and Queens, and he, as you mentioned, he was a mobster. He was a member of the Gambino family. And during that time, he lived a life of violence, crimes. He was arrested and incarcerated for some time during that time. And he became a raging alcohol and drug addict. And, you know, James is a person who lived a life of pure selfishness, right? His life was all about him. And he, throughout his life, he never once thought about animals. He didn't care about animals. He saw them as dirty nuisances, you know, saw there was no need for animals in this world. And, but he met a woman, as you mentioned, the crazy cat lady on Brooklyn, who became the love of his life. And she was a kind-hearted woman who would rescue the cats and dogs who would find their way into her garden. And, you know, she would just open her hearts up to them and help them. And even during that time, with all these animals around him, James had no interest in these animals. He found nothing for them. And that was a source of arguments a lot between James and Lena. And so... but it wasn't until one day he was sitting at a cafe outside from this pet store that they were partners in, that they were building. It was a pet supply store. And James was sitting at this cafe and he saw something across the road that looked kind of unusual. And he went up to it and he saw that there was what looked like a mat, a beaten down mat tied to a parking meter. Was a dog. And this was a very, very abused dog he found. The dog was just full of broken bones. The dog was barely alive. And something happened when James met this dog. That empathy, which I think was always there, but he never really experienced for another animal before, suddenly emerged. And James became really angry. He didn't understand how could someone do such a thing to an animal, to an innocent creature. And so he took the dog into the veterinary hospital. He paid for the dog to be taken care of. And when he went back to get the dog after the dog was treated by the veterinary hospital for a few days, the dog did something that really awakened his empathy even further, and the dog licked his face. And James said, how can, you know, I can't believe that this dog who was so abused by a human could still feel this love and, you know, just this appreciation of another human. And that just had a remarkable effect on James. The bond that he formed with this dog was just, had a profound change on his life. And he then gave up alcohol and drugs. And he's been alcohol and drug-free since. It's been more than a decade. And he's now devoted his life to saving and rescuing animals. The pet store is just a supply store. They don't sell animals there. Is to help raise money for a shelter that he runs now, where he rescues animals and he tries to adopt them out. And so James found this new way of being. His life transformed into such a better one. Because he recognized something in that abused dog, that, and he, I think he saw something you know, he saw just a way, a dog who can show love and appreciation regardless of how he was treated.
You've also written that animals can act as social lubricants. Can you tell us a bit more about that, please?
Yeah, I think you even talked about this in the very beginning, Joe, when you were talking about people love seeing when you see someone walking a dog, you're more likely to go up and talk to that person. Studies are showing that we are much more likely to approach a stranger if that stranger has a companion animal. Usually it's dogs because they're the ones we tend to be out in the streets with, but it could be other animals as well. There was one study that looked at folks who were bound in wheelchairs, and some had dogs and some didn't, and they found that those who had dogs were much more likely to be approached by strangers who would come and talk to them. And some sociologists call what we do in these situations, they call it triangulation. So if you see someone who has a dog on the street, you're very likely to go not talk to the person necessarily right away, but to the dog, right? You say, "Hi, Poochie, how are you? Aren't you a good doggy?" And you may start petting the dog and so on. And the reason why we do this, according to many sociologists, is because we feel more at ease talking with the animal than we do with a stranger. But by talking with the animal, by interacting with that animal, it does lead to interaction with the person as well. So we're more likely to make a connection with that person. I found this when my husband and I are walking in our neighborhoods. We find that if our neighbors have a dog or if there's a cat out in the front yard with them, we're much more likely to stop. And first we want to, you know, go pet the dog or the cat. And then that inevitably leads us to introducing ourselves to the humans. And then we get to know our neighbors more. And in that way, animals truly are social lubricants.
Well, we want to encourage people to ask permission before they pet the dog or
yeah.
the cat. But you're absolutely right that a dog can really bring a lot of people together. We have friends whose beautiful Irish setter was a tremendous favorite in the neighborhood, and our friends got to know just about everybody in their neighborhood because of their dog.
There was a funny study. This was published a little while back in the newspapers. It was a man who wanted to see how frequently he can get phone numbers from women for a date. And he found a significantly higher ability to get women's phone numbers when he had a dog with him. I think that says something, right? I think that not only are animals social lubricants, but we like people who like animals. It says something about people when they're in a positive relationship, when they show kindness to animals. It suggests that these are people who can be kind and empathetic in general, even with us.
Dr. Akhtar, I wonder if you could share with us the individuals or groups that seem to benefit from a companion animal. And I'm thinking now, you know, maybe Alzheimer's patients, even people recovering from surgery, having an animal as part of the hospital protocol, or perhaps even people who are grieving or dealing with stress and anxiety. I mean, where can you imagine animals playing an important healing role?
You know, I think the question would be, where can animals not play an important healing role? And that I don't know. I think animals can play a healing role for all of us. And you're right. It for mental illnesses, animals can play a healing role. They found for depression, especially for loneliness, for in the elderly, for example, animals can help individuals be more active mentally and physically. And that mental activity by having this relationship with an animal is good to keep them. It helps ward off dementia as well. Animals have shown to be very beneficial for people with physical ailments. As you've seen, horse therapy is one case where people with spinal cord injuries, for example, have really benefited from being around horses. The only thing I would say is that, obviously, the reason to adopt an animal would not be because you expect them to provide some kind of healing for you. You know, I hope that's not what I'm trying to say, what is coming about from this, but, you know, we adopting an animal because you want to help an animal and because you want that companionship, I would suggest that would be the way to go about adopting an animal. But from that companionship, and if you have a good, strong bond with the animal, it can be that bond can be so therapeutic. I know even just for myself, my cats have been, and Sylvester, how therapeutic they've been. And I don't think there's, even for people, even just our everyday stressors in life, animals have been shown to help us step away from that. You know, when you think about it, when you, at the end of a very stressful, long work day, when you walk in your front door of your home, and let's say your dog or your cat comes and greets you, you know, don't you just feel your blood pressure lowering and your heart rate lowering?
Absolutely.
You just feel. Yeah, you just feel sort of, even if it's temporary, you just feel a sense of relief from the stress of the day. And I think so, I think animals have that effect on, or can have that effect on any of us.
Dr. Akhtar, you've been talking a lot about this bond between humans and animals, and we get that. It's quite extraordinary, but there's a flip side of the coin, and that is when we lose a companion animal, it can hurt so much. It's so painful. It's almost as bad as losing a loved one. Well, they are loved ones. And I'm not always sure that friends or family understand or appreciate the pain that we go through when we lose a dear friend, a companion animal. How can you help us better understand that process?
Losing a companion animal is for, if you love the animal, it's really no different from losing another person. I think one of the hard things for us is when we lose an animal is because, you know, their lives with us are so short. A dog may live 13, 14 years. A cat may live 18 years. And it's hard for many of us to lose them just because we realize how beautiful that life was with that animal, but how short that was in so many ways. But studies show that our loss and the way we grieve and how strongly we grieve can be just as strong for an animal as it can be for another human being. If you have a strong bond with an animal, it's no different than if you have a strong bond with another person. And society has been slow to recognize that. And I've seen that, especially with doctors and psychologists and psychiatrists, have been rather slow to recognize that deep bond and as a result of that deep mourning we can feel when we lose that animal. I do think, though, that we are slowly starting to change. And that's because so more and more of us have companion animals in this country, and we're calling them, we're not calling them, they're our pets, and we're not their owners, but they're our babies, our fur babies, and we're their parents. And so even our language is reflecting that changing relationship with animals. So I do see hope, and then I do see people starting to recognize that losing an animal can be incredibly hard for all of us. And that's part of the healing process as well, is that we need to be empathetic to those who do lose an animal and recognize that deep grief that they could be experiencing.
I think one health profession that definitely recognizes that grief are veterinarians. And we have a friend who was conducting workshops on Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's approach to grief, and was asked to come and help the personnel at a veterinary clinic. The idea was that she would help them understand this framework so that they could help their clients. Well, she got there and she started the workshop, and all of a sudden realized that all of these people were dealing with the grief that they have to deal with when one of their patients dies as well.
Yeah, it's amazing. I personally don't know how these folks in veterinary hospitals and clinics can work there, because I know if it were me, I'd be a mess. It is a significant issue. It's something that we must acknowledge, that as the beautiful, deep bonds with animals are so special, that we experience with animals are so special that when we lose them, we lose something in the core of our beings as well. And we need to recognize how strong those relationships are.
Our time with you is almost up. Is there anything else that our listeners should take from your book, Our Symphony with Animals?
What I hoped with the book was to show how empathetic, kind relationships with animals not only can boost our well-being, but is vital to our well-being. And that I really see that when we show empathy for animals and we experience that empathy for animals, it also helps us experience empathy for each other. And, you know, not to be Pollyannish about this, but I think that by recognizing that empathy for animals and seeing them is not so different from us, to help blur that stark line that we normally put between humans and other animals, I think by doing that, we will also help blur the lines amongst ourselves as well. We will start to see other people as not so different from us. So I see empathy for animals as the inevitable extension of our empathy for each other.
Dr. Aisha Akhtar, thank you ever so much for talking with us on The People's Pharmacy today.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to Dr. Aisha Akhtar. She's board certified in both neurology and preventive medicine. She holds a master's degree in public health. Dr. Akhtar is deputy director of the Army's Traumatic Brain Injury Program. She's a lieutenant commander in the U.S. Public Health Service, in which she deploys to assist with national public health emergencies. Dr. Akhtar is a fellow of the Oxford Center for Animal Ethics and a consultant editor for the Journal of Animal Ethics. Her books include Animals and Public Health and her most recent, Our Symphony with Animals, on health, empathy, and our shared destinies.
Lynn Siegel produced today's show. Al Wodarski engineered. Dave Graydon edits our interviews.
The People's Pharmacy is produced at the studios of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC.
The People's Pharmacy theme music is by B.J. Lederman.
People's Pharmacy is brought to you in part by Verizana, an analytical laboratory providing home health tests for hormones, gut health, and the microbiome, online at verisana.com.
If you'd like to buy a CD of today's show or any other People's Pharmacy broadcast, you can call 800-732-2334. Today's show is number 1176. The number again, 800-732-2334, or place your order online at peoplespharmacy.com.
When you visit our site, you can share your thoughts about today's show. Have you ever had a special relationship with an animal? Please share your story.
At peoplespharmacy.com, you can sign up for our free online newsletter or subscribe to the free podcast of the show.
In Durham, North Carolina, I'm Joe Graydon.
And I'm Terry Graydon. Thanks for listening. Join us again next week.